It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
A U.S. grand jury decides not to charge a white policeman in the controversial fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager. And residents flee a northern Nigerian town attacked by suspected Islamic militants. I'm Michael Lippin. A U.S. grand jury in the Midwestern state of Missouri has decided not to charge a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager during a street confrontation 4 months ago. The August shooting of Michael Brown in the town of Ferguson inflamed racial tensions in the predominantly black St. Louis suburb that is patrolled by an overwhelmingly white police force. It also triggered violent protests by residents and activists angered by what they saw as an unjustified and racially motivated killing of a black youth by the white policeman Darren Wilson. But a local prosecutor told the media late Monday that a grand jury decided there were not sufficient grounds to indict Wilson after considering physical evidence and often contradictory testimony from witnesses. The prosecutor said the evidence showed that Brown approached Wilson while the officer was in his police car, and the two engaged in a physical confrontation before Wilson opened fire and Brown ran away. The prosecutor said Wilson gave chase and fired more shots, some of them fatal, when Brown stopped and turned toward the officer. Brown's family expressed profound disappointment with the ruling. It is said Brown was trying to surrender to the officer. Wilson's supporters say he acted in self-defense. Reports from Nigeria say a suspected Boko Haram militants have attacked a northeastern town near the border with Niger, killing a number of residents. There was no official word on casualties from Monday's attack on the town of Damasak in Borno State. Witnesses said the militants arrived in a convoy and began shooting. Residents fled toward nearby Niger for safety. This is VOA News. New satellite imagery of a Chinese land reclamation project in disputed waters of the South China Sea is drawing concern from the Philippines. The imagery of Fiery Cross Reef appears to show Chinese construction that would enable the island to support an airstrip. The reef also is claimed by the Philippines, which says China's behavior is a reminder of the region's need for a code of conduct in the South China Sea. The code is a proposed agreement that would include China and the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. Simone Orendine has more on the Philippine reaction to China's moves.
Department spokesman Charles Jose says the Chinese construction points to the need for ASEAN to pass guidelines on maintaining the status quo in the disputed region.
Of course, for us, it's something that raises tension in the area. And of course, we would like to de-escalate tension, and we would like to manage tension in the area. And that's the reason why we are working with ASEAN and China.
Last week, the defense and security analyst publication IHS Jane's Defense Weekly released satellite images taken on November 14th of ongoing reclamation work at Fiery Cross, which is in the heart of the disputed sea. Apart from the Philippines and China, Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam all have claims in the Spratt lease and the wider South China Sea. Simone Orendine for VOA News, Manila.
Several co-founders of Hong Kong's pro-democracy Occupy movement say they will surrender to police next month to take responsibility for almost 2 months of street blockades in the city. Local media say the three Occupy activists intend to surrender on or after December 5th. They say the activists announced their decision last week in a meeting with allies from other pro-democracy factions, including the Hong Kong Federation of Students and Scholarism, another student group. Student protest leaders have said they will not surrender to police, preferring instead to remain in occupied street areas and wait to be arrested. U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel has resigned after only 21 months in the position. President Barack Obama announced the resignation at the White House on Monday, with Hagel and Vice President Joe Biden at his side. Mr. Obama said the defense secretary told him last month that it was time to move on. The New York Times quoted senior U.S. officials as saying Mr. Obama pressured Hagel to quit in order to make way for a new defense secretary with the skills needed to deal with a series of foreign policy crises. But in his remarks on Monday, Mr. Obama praised Hagel as a steady hand in helping his administration. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning for Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some civil society groups say they have concerns about Burkina Faso's new Minister of Culture.
We cannot understand why somebody like him can be appointed as a minister in this cabinet. Therefore, he has been removed.
Isaka Traore is a member of Burkina Faso's civil society in charge of communication and information. South Sudan and Egypt signed new bilateral agreements. Ghana has a funding program to help the extremely poor. And Mali takes steps to prevent the spread of Ebola.
At the border, Malian health workers now check everyone who comes in. They say their orders are to turn back anyone with a medical condition.
That's VOA correspondent Ian Locke in Bamako. Police use breathalyzers to curb traffic carnage on Kenya roads. And a grand jury in the U.S. state of Missouri has decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A member of Burkina Faso's civil society says some people are unhappy with the appointment of Adama Sagnon as Minister of Culture and Tourism, and they would like for his name to be withdrawn from the list of the country's new 26-member cabinet. Isaka Traore, in charge of civil society communication and information, says Mr. Sagnon, as prosecutor in the case of the murder of journalist Norbert Zongo in 1998, did little to bring about justice. Zongo had investigated the murder of the driver of Francois Compaoré, the former president's brother. Traore hopes Prime Minister Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida and Interim President Michel Kafando will listen to the voices of the Burkinabe people because the government in which they currently serve came about as a result of the sweat and blood of the people.
There was no criteria for us as a civil society organization or any quota. So it was up to the Prime Minister to appoint who he wants to appoint in his cabinet. Nevertheless, we expect that some people with integrity who have the sense of public management should be appointed. And so far, there is only one case, as I said, who people are not happy and people feel really disappointed. And this is the case of Mr. Adama Sagnon, who was a prosecutor and a very sensitive case in following the assassination of the journalist, the investigative journalist, Mr. Norbert Zongo, in 1998. And they never gave justice to Norbert Zongo and his family. And that they didn't found anyone who was responsible for this killing. And so this person cannot be appointed in this cabinet because this cabinet is the result of an uprising of the people of Burkina Faso, grassroots people. Some were wounded and killed in the hospital. And to appoint someone like Mr. Adama Sagnon is an insult for us as a society organization. Today, there was a demonstration in front of his ministry, and people are asking Mr. Prime Minister Zida to remove Mr. Adama Sagnon from his position.
The former prosecutor, you say he prosecuted in the case of the journalist who was murdered. Did the civil society don't want him in this particular government, as you said?
The civil society organization, we don't want him in this cabinet, and the people, the grassroots people, don't want him in the cabinet. That's why they went to this ministry and demonstrated this morning. Because this man who was appointed as Minister of Culture yesterday evening was not able to bring justice, was not able to bring the victim of this killing. We cannot understand why somebody like him can be appointed as a minister in this cabinet. Therefore, he has been removed.
Do you think Mr. Kafando is going to listen to the protesters?
Well, I think if they want peace to remain and stability to remain in this country, they have to listen to the people because they were not elected. If Mr. Kafando and Mr. Zida are where they are today, it's because of the people who went on the street. They have to listen to the people.
Isaka Traore is a member of Burkina Faso's civil society in charge of communication and information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. Senegal and Nigeria were able to stop small Ebola outbreaks by closely monitoring those who had contact with a sick person and quickly isolating anyone with symptoms. Mali is scrambling to do the same now, almost a month after a 70-year-old Guinean imam sought treatment at a clinic in Bamako. Five people have already died. Viewers and local reports from Mali on what the country is doing to shut down the chain of transmission.
Every day, twice a day, teams are checking just over 300 people around Bamako. All of these contacts are linked to the Ghanaian imam, who died of Ebola at a private clinic October 27th. 2 days after he had arrived for treatment. Monitors have caught just one case so far, a female relative of a nurse who died after treating the imam. The nurse had the most contacts, 98. BOA accompanied monitors to the house. At least 40 family members line up in the courtyard to have their temperatures taken. Two boys, the self-appointed soap police, man a hand-washing station at the door. The head of the household scolds one boy who takes too long to get up when his name is called. The monitors ask about symptoms. The first half of one monitor's spreadsheet is column after column of tiny handwritten zeros. No symptoms. Not all of the contacts are as cooperative as this family. A few do go missing. Monitors think one man went to his village, but phone networks are bad. You haven't been able to reach him, Dr. Ramada Sacco asked the team at a meeting later. Didn't we tell him not to travel? Dr. Sacco is coordinating Ebola monitoring efforts. The teams are learning on the job. If they don't come to us, we go to them, she tells the team. If we can't figure out his village, we can see if there's a health post there and get him that way. Because this is a critical period, she says. We don't want him to develop symptoms there. Molly is playing catch-up. The circle of contacts widened rapidly in the 2 weeks that went by before health authorities here found out about the imam. The clinic had not tested him. The World Health Organization in Guinea figured it out while investigating other cases in the imam's family. Dr. Ibrahima Sose Fall of the WHO in Mali got the news. By then, at least three people in Mali were already sick. It's a cautionary tale for other countries in the region. Dr. Fall says this never should have happened in a private or a public clinic. Everyone knows the situation in Guinea. Had we known sooner, he says, we could have prevented a certain number of contacts. It was late. Mali is investigating the clinic and how the sick imam got past border police in Koromale. The town straddles the border. The imam was from the Ghanaian side. He was buried there after he died in Bamako. At the border, Malian health workers now check everyone who comes in. Health workers write down names, phone numbers, destinations. They say their orders are to turn back anyone with a medical condition. But an infected person may not show symptoms at the border. Ebola has a 21-day incubation period. The whole country has to be vigilant. And look, VOA News, Koromale, Mali.
A social cash transfer program in Ghana under which funds and health insurance premiums are provided by government to extremely poor families now covers more than 77,000 households throughout the country. Joanna Mete tells us more about the program from Accra.
The program, known as Livelihood Empowerment Against Poverty, has been going on for 6 years now. Its broad objective is to lessen the impact of poverty on society's most vulnerable people. Beneficiaries, including orphans, people with severe disabilities, and the aged, are given bi-monthly cash support ranging from $15 to $30 per family. The program is administered by the Department of Social Welfare and Ministry of Gender, Children, and Social Protection. Mauto Ablo is a director at the ministry. He says an impact assessment indicates that funds given out generate multiplier effects in local communities that results in a twofold increase in the amount of money flowing in the economy.
Some are investing it, and some also, you know, they buy goods and services from the community. So it creates opportunity for those who are selling also to bring in more, you know, goods and services to provide to the community. And by so doing, the money is affecting even those who are non-beneficiaries.
Participants are allowed to enlist on condition that they immunize and send their children to school. Ablo says that initiative is improving on the education status of children from poor families, but there are challenges. The program is supported by government and donor partners such as UNICEF and aid agency Department for International Development. There have been instances when budgetary constraints have created funding difficulties for Ghana's government and delayed financial support to beneficiaries.
That belongs to history. We used to have this problem in the past, but for almost 1.5 years now, we have been very, very regular in the disbursement of the grant.
However, cash transfer for the months of September and October were made in November this year, Other limitations include the need for capacity building for staff at the district level, where most of the funds are disbursed. Some caregivers also create difficulties by collecting and keeping monies meant for upkeep of their older relatives, Ablo explains.
Initially, some people thought it's just a handout, so we need to do a lot of sensitization for people to understand, sharing the results of the impact assessment to indicate that indeed cash transfers can contribute to social and economic development.
Minister of Gender, Children and Social Protection, Nana Oyelita, says there are plans to scale up the program to cover 150,000 households by 2015. Some five beneficiaries at Jamestown in Accra told this reporter they would like to see an upgrade in their health insurance status to cover a wider treatment option. Joanna Manti for VOA News, Accra.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 25th. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. South Sudan officials have been given details of numerous bilateral agreements reached between South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his Egyptian counterpart Abdel Fattah al-Sisi following their recent meeting in Cairo. The agreements signed on Saturday will yield numerous development projects for South Sudan worth $26 million. Philip Tong Aliu reports for VOA from Juba.
Awana Riag, the minister in President Kiir's office, briefed reporters in Juba yesterday about the details of President Kiir's trip to Cairo last week. Riag says the nine ministers and several businessmen who accompanied President Kiir met with the Egyptian counterparts and agree on many projects.
These included the areas of water and electricity, education, youth and sports, petroleum, and many other things, including the health. So it was a very successful visit, and both countries are looking to close their ties together to benefit from the expertise of one another and also the resources that are in our country.
Riag says Egyptian President El-Sisi held a one-to-one meeting with President Kiir to discuss issues of mutual interest to both countries. South Sudan and Egypt are members of the Nile Basin Initiative, or NBI, which brings together nations connected by the Nile River. Egypt is a loggerhead with Ethiopia over the construction of multi-million dollar Ethiopian dams that Egypt says will dramatically reduce the volume of the Nile River. Minister Riag says Ethiopian new dams on the Nile and their impact on Egypt, South Sudan, and other countries in the NBI were discussed by the two leaders.
The issues to do with the Nile water, where we need to clear the River Nile so that more water could go, because these are all things that were embodied in the visit, and we are looking forward to see them progressing.
Riag says clearing the Nile, which involves removing sand and cutting papyrus, will also allow river transportation between Sudan, South Sudan, and Egypt to resume. He says transporting goods by water will be much cheaper than transporting them by air, which is how companies in Cairo and Juba normally do business. Both countries also agreed to collaborate on 10 water projects worth $26 million US dollars, which are slated to start next month. Some analysts believe the cooperative agreement between Juba and Cairo is an attempt to dissuade the world's newest nation from constructing hydroelectric dams on the Nile. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
Kenyan roads claimed more than 3,000 fatalities each year. In a bid to reduce drunk driving-related accidents, breathalyzers have been deployed throughout the country. A special task force has been charged with ensuring the roads are kept free from those who violate the law, and authorities say it seems to be paying off. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi.
It is 10 p.m. along one of Kenya's busiest highways, Jogoo Road. In Nairobi, police have set up a roadblock to conduct random checks for intoxicated drivers. Breathalyzers, which measure blood alcohol content from air expelled from a person's mouth, were first introduced in Kenya 3 years ago to curb a steep increase in drunken driving accidents and deaths. A breathalyzer kit costs approximately $2,000. And the National Transport and Safety Authority has deployed 12 kits throughout the country. The NTSA works in tandem with the Kenyan police, so police cannot solicit bribes from drivers caught intoxicated. Cosmas Ngesu from the NTSA says this approach helps with enforcement of drunk driving laws.
But we have also done it. We are partnered with the Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission. We also monitor this operation, send their people. So we are checking an issue of corruption.
That was reporter Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi. A grand jury in the Midwestern U.S. state of Missouri has decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager during a street confrontation almost 4 months ago. The panel has been considering charges against Darren Wilson, the suburban St. Louis officer who fatally shot Michael Brown on August 9th. The shooting inflamed tensions in the predominantly black St. Louis suburb that is patrolled by an overwhelmingly white police force. Here is Robert McCullum, St. Louis County prosecutor.
Beginning August 20th and continuing until today, the grand jury worked tirelessly to examine and re-examine all of the testimony of the witnesses and all of the physical evidence. They met on 25 separate days in the last 3 months, heard more than 70 hours of testimony from about 60 witnesses, and reviewed hours and hours of recordings of media and law enforcement interviews by many of the witnesses who testified. They heard from three medical examiners and experts on blood, DNA, toxicology, firearms, and drug analysis. They examined hundreds of photographs, some of which they asked be taken. They examined various pieces of physical evidence. They were instructed on the law and presented with five indictments ranging from murder in the first degree to involuntary manslaughter. Their burden was to determine, based upon all of the evidence, if probable cause exists to believe that a crime was committed and that Darren Wilson is the person who committed that crime. There is no question, of course, that Darren Wilson caused the death of Michael Brown by shooting him, but the inquiry does not end there. The law authorizes a law enforcement officer to use deadly force in certain situations. The law also allows all people to use deadly force to defend themselves in certain situations. So the grand jury considered whether Wilson was the initial aggressor in this case, or whether there was probable cause to believe that Darren Wilson was authorized as a law enforcement officer to use deadly force in this situation, or if he acted in self-defense. I detail this for two reasons. First, so that everyone will know that, as promised by me and Attorney General Holder, there was a full investigation and presentation of all evidence and appropriate instruction of law to the jury, to the grand jury. Second, as a caution to those in and out of the media who will pounce on a single sentence or a single witness and decide what should have happened in this case based on that tiny bit of information. The duty of the grand jury is to separate fact from fiction. After a full and impartial and critical examination of all the evidence in the law and decide if that evidence supported the filing of any criminal charges against Darren Wilson, they accepted and completed this monumental responsibility in a conscientious and expeditious manner. It is important to note here and say again that they are the only people who have heard and examined every witness and every piece of evidence. They discussed and debated the evidence among themselves before arriving at their collective decision. After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the five indictments. The physical and scientific evidence examined by the grand jury, combined with the witness statements supported and substantiated by that physical evidence, tells the accurate and tragic story of what happened.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with football. The Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA has declined the Royal Morocco Football Federation's invitation to the opening match at the FIFA Club World Cup in the Moroccan capital, Rabat, next month, COSAFA disclosed in Johannesburg, South Africa, on Monday. COSAFA brings together the National Football Associations of Angola, Botswana, Comoro Islands, Lesotho, Madagascar, Malawi, Mauritius, Mozambique, and Namibia, Seychelles, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia and Zimbabwe. COSAFA's action could mark the start of an African backlash against Morocco for withdrawing from hosting the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations scheduled to kick off on the 17th of January, claiming it is to prevent the spread of the Ebola disease to Morocco. The Moroccans are keen to stage the FIFA Club World Cup next month. Apart from Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan and Algeria's newly crowned Orange Africa Champions League title holders Intensitif, the other five teams in the contest come from outside Africa. Yet 13 of the 16 teams set to play in the Nations Cup hail from sub-Saharan Africa. COSAFA pledged its full support to the Global Watch campaign, whose clarion call is no to racism and discrimination in sports. In cycling, 20-year-old Valine Ndayisenga won the Tour of Rwanda in the Rwanda capital Kigali over the weekend. He's the first Rwandese cyclist to win the Tour of Rwanda since the inception of the annual week-long cycling contest in 2009. Rwanda's Jean Bosco Nsengimana was second ahead of Eritrean Aaron Debretsion. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian former champions Wuda Ayeleu and Asmerao Bekele were crowned women's and men's winners at the Great Ethiopian Run, Africa's biggest 10-kilometer road race in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa on Sunday. Ayeleu covered the distance in 34 minutes and 4 seconds to win her third title, having prevailed in 2008 and 2009. Bekele clocked 30 minutes and 12 seconds to claim the men's crown. He also won the event in 2010. Finally, World Championship 5,000-meter silver medalist Mercy Cherono and Doris Chengeiwo clinched a Kenyan 1-2 triumph in the women's race at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Soria, Spain on Sunday. Uganda's Timothy Toroitich prevailed in the men's race. Eritrean Tekle Mariam Mehdim was runner-up ahead of Kenyan Emmanuel Bett. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A grand jury in the Midwestern U.S. state of Missouri has decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager during a street confrontation almost 4 months ago. The panel has been considering charges against Darren Wilson, the suburban St. Louis officer who fatally shot Michael Brown on August 9th. The shooting inflamed tensions in the predominantly black St. Louis suburb that is patrolled by an overwhelmingly white police force. Earlier in the day, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon called for peace, respect, and restraint. Nixon said the National Guard is being deployed to provide support to the local police. Protest groups from around the country were expected to descend on Ferguson if the officer were exonerated. Burkina Faso's military has held on to power post in a new cabinet unveiled Sunday, 3 weeks after the army took over following a popular revolt. Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida will remain prime minister and also take over as defense minister. The military likewise will have control of four other ministries, interior and territorial administration, sports, environment, and mines. Interior Civilian President Michel Kafando also will function as foreign minister. Burkina Faso's former president Blaise Compaoré was forced from power by mass protests in October after he sought to amend the constitution to prolong his 27-year rule. That is it for this Tuesday, November 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty, Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer James Harmon, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Tuesday.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.